industrial trade union organization of the American working class today. Now, it's unfortunate that Comrade Dunn can't be present tonight because he isn't feeling so good. And this throws a little added burden on myself, because I didn't figure on having to go into many of the details of the IWW, because Comrade Dunn was figured on to go into these details because he himself lived through them. And it's one thing to relate it from history, and another thing to be a participant in the IWW and to have gone through the great experiences of the IWW. Now, and I wish the comrades would keep that in mind when I stumble along here. Now, by the year 1900, we might say that the great expansion of American capitalism that took place due to the accumulation of capital in the Civil War more or less came to a halt. That is, the last frontier had been wiped out. The country was a unified force now from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and immense, gigantic fortunes that had never been imagined before were accumulated in the period from the ending of the Civil War up to the 1900. Fortunes like the Rockefeller fortune, the McKay fortune that built the old postal service that you comrades don't know about, but afterwards merged with the Western Union, Postal Telegraph, the building of the railroads and the amassing of the great fortunes of the Vanderbilts, the Goulds, the great accumulated fortune of the great gangster, the Astor family, and so forth up and down the line. Side by side with this came the development that Comrade Dunn told us about the other night. But he confined it mainly to the Scandinavian immigrants that came to this country full of hopes about being a great landowner and a great successful farmer, and making enough dough out of it so that in a few years they could retire or probably go back to the old country. Well, side by side with the migration of these millions of Scandinavians that poured out to the Middle West came also a migration from the eastern seaboard. As you know, New England particularly continually exported to the West, going back to colonial times, continually exported pioneers to the West. The West at one time being the Hudson River, then going into the Northwest Territory, then branching out further across the plains into the up to the Pacific. Now, these migrants from New England also went west on the idea that they were going to grab off a piece of land and become big, wealthy farmers. But we understand the laws of capitalism, and instead of a vast multitude being rich, the laws of capitalism work in agriculture the same as in any other field of capitalist production. The result was that not only were the Scandinavians driven off the land and driven into Minneapolis, as Comrade Dunn pointed out the other night, but tens and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of Americans that of the first, second, and third generation were likewise driven off the land and forced to sell their labor power. These elements were the cream, you might say, of the American people, because they were the adventuristic types that had the spirit of pulling up stakes and striking out on their own to accumulate some kind of wealth, to have security and so forth. And this was in direct opposition, of course, to the arrogant, money-mad capitalist class that had accumulated their great fortunes after the Civil War and up to the years 1900. At this period, I'm talking about the period, say, 1890 to 1900, the American Federation of Labor, as we described the other night, had somewhere around 1 million members. By this time, they had more or less laid down their policy of craft unionism and a silent but vicious and unrelenting opposition to industrial unionism. They were class collaborators, that is the leadership and the elements that control the American Federation of Labor. They broke the strikes of the industrial workers in one industry after another, such as the American Press Steel strike that I described in very brief terms to the comrades. I described how they tried to chop up the brewery workers, demanding that the brewery drivers join the Teamsters Union. I described how they broke up the strike of the American Railway Union, founded and led by Eugene V. Debs in the famous Pullman strike of 1894. And alongside of these demonstrations of their anti-union, anti-working class attitude, these leaders of the craft unions in the United States carried on a relentless struggle against the Western Federation of Miners. Now you have the United Mine Workers, which is the union of the miners, as everybody thinks, but that's the union of the coal miners. And that's confined mainly in the east here, where we have the coal mining regions in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and in that area. But to the west, in the Rocky Mountain District, we have the great mines of gold, silver, lead, copper, and so forth. And these miners were organized separately and apart from the coal miners. And they formed what was known as the Western Federation of Miners. Now, the Western Federation of Miners was organized around 1894 as a result of some horrifying struggles that these miners carried on against the mine owners. As you know, from probably your own experience, someone that never had a dime in their life, when they get a few bucks, they're the meanest creatures that ever crawled in shoe leather. They become the most graspy elements going in order to protect their little niche. Well, you can imagine these, a miner in the West, working for nothing, begging, borrowing, and stealing anything he can lay his hands on in order to go out prospecting. And lo and behold, some fine day he finds himself in the possession of a gold mine, or a silver mine, or a copper mine, or a lead mine, and so forth. In other words, overnight, these ignorant people, individuals, overnight became super multimillionaires. I don't mean $10 million, I mean $100 million and so forth. Like McKay, who founded the Postal Telegraph in this country, who made his money out of the silver mines in Virginia City. Well, this Virginia City was only one of dozens of mines in the West that were discovered by individual prospectors, and overnight it started to employ hundreds and thousands of fellow miners to accumulate their wealth from. Now, in this period of time, side by side with the great strikes that I'll go into very briefly, that were carried on by the Western Federation of Miners, or even previous to the founding of their union, we must remember that there was no such a thing as we have today: Social Security, old age pension, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, and so forth and so on. Those were all things that interfered with private initiative, and no real red-blooded American in those days, I suppose, would ever stand for such things. You take Bill Haywood, whom we'll talk about tonight, the great strike leader of the IWW and probably the most popular strike leader in this country outside of Eugene V. Debs, had lost his eye in the mines. And one of his arms was more or less paralyzed. They thought he would lose one of his legs in another mine accident. But there was no such a thing as Bill Haywood saying, "Hey, I'm going to sue you for losing my eye." Or, "Where's my compensation?" There was nothing like that. You just went on your own, and you said a prayer to God that he would cure you so you could go back to work and become get slaughtered again in the mines. So this gives you a picture of what conditions the miners faced in those days. Then side by side with that, you had uh, absolutely no such an animal as any kind of unionism that amounted to a row of pins. The government was lined up 100% against the working people forming unions, mainly on the basis that it was a conspiracy. The same as the feudal lords indicted the early developing capitalist society, much on the same plane, as a conspiracy against society. You had the church lined up 100% against unionism. Today in Massachusetts alone, there's 19 schools run by the Jesuit priests, explaining to the nice, loyal Massachusetts trade unionists of the principles of trade unionism. But the Catholic Church opposed trade unionism 100%, 100%. Where they couldn't do it openly, they sabotaged it underneath the board. The law was 100% organized against trade unions. And we know what politicians are, pretty low elements. After a while, after holding office a few years, they descend to the level of that can't be described. They'll sell their mother for a dime, they'll run a steamroller over their mother if they can get ahead. All they want to do is get ahead. And they serve the master. And in the United States in this period, they were at the beck and call of the capitalists anytime the capitalists needed them. That meant that if a strike occurred and it looked pretty bad for the capitalists, the police would take the necessary measures to see that the strike was broken. If the strike was on a larger measure, then the militia or the state guard was called out in order to break the strike. Now, out in the West, where you had a hangover of the pioneer stock and the hangover of the great spirit of adventurism, the spirit of real rugged individualism, where you had the vast majority of first generation being pushed into the mines, it was very easy to develop a rebellious attitude and spirit among these individuals. That meant that there was constant strife between the mine union, the miners, and the mine owners, which meant the state. It's figured that about this time, the turn of the century, there were approximately 2 million transient workers in the United States. Many of them followed the crops as they came into season, starting from Texas right up into Canada, following the wheat crops. Many of them worked in the woods. Many of them went into shipping. So this whole area of the West gave a fertile soil for a rebellious attitude developing among these exploited workers. Since they were transient workers, they couldn't bury their roots, they couldn't deepen their roots into any particular neighborhood where they could have any political influence. So the politician, on top of being a tool of the capitalist, wasn't concerned about losing a few votes if the state guard came out and shot down a few Mr. X's. That's all they amounted to as far as the politician was concerned. Then, above everything else, in having the cards stacked against the miners and against unionization in those days, was the famous yellow dog contract. When you went to work, the boss could say, well, you know, we don't allow any union men in this shop or in this mine or on this ship. So what we want you to do is to sign a contract to show your rugged individualism, that you can stand on your own feet. We want you to sign a contract of yourself saying that you agree to work for us for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and that you will not have anybody else represent you. That was the famous yellow dog contract that was outlawed around 1934 by the Wagner Act. And in these mines in the West, many of the miners were signed up on a yellow dog contract basis. I might say that when they had strikes in these mines in the West, it was quite customary after the militia was called out for the generous-hearted and patriotic capitalists to give the boys a little bonus after they broke the strike for them. So that it was an open manifestation by the capitalists that the militia and the police belonged to them. Give you a further idea of the relationship between law and order, that is the capitalist class, the owning class, and the working class in those days. Up until 1934 in Pennsylvania, not out in the West, where men are men and so forth and so on, but in Pennsylvania, there was a special private police force known as the Coal and Iron Police, completely independent of the government of the state of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. This police force was organized, directed, and controlled by the coal and steel barons of Pennsylvania. They were the ones that broke the great steel strike of 1919. We described about in Ford, Comrade Lowell described Harry Bennett and his gang of unfortunate parolees, how this private police force policed the Ford factories and drove out any possibility of unionism in it. And then the average factory or the average mine had their own private police force that was completely independent of any control by the government. They were private armies of gunmen, that's what they were. Now in this period we also had another development that we never see today. Can you just picture some prominent lawyer or a group of prominent lawyers standing up and telling the government that that you people are nothing but a pack of errand boys for Wall Street. And in this strike situation, we're going to defend the strikers. Well, they said, well, what do you mean? Well, you can't be our lawyer anymore if you're going to defend these roughnecks, these strikers. Big lawyers that are lawyers for big corporations. All they have to do is sign their death warrant by agreeing to defend working men on strike, working men that have been indicted on the basis of civil rights and so forth and so on. Well, previous to the First World War, there were quite a number of lawyers in this country that weren't for sale. The most notable, of course, was Clarence Darrow. But side by side with Clarence Darrow were hundreds, I would say, of lawyers that stood on their own feet and possessed their own soul, that would defend the working men on strike, working people in any kind of troubles. And many of these were friends of the IWW. Unfortunately, I can't go into a number of them. But in one instance, a lawyer for the IWW, who was a judge on top of it, in Colorado, wrote a letter to the governor of Colorado, and today you'd say the man is very uncouth to write such a letter to His Majesty. But he told him, you're nothing but a hireling, for Christ's sake. You're a despicable character. You haven't got the guts to defend these poor working men that go into the bowels of the earth and dig out the wealth for these money-crazed multimillionaires. You're nothing but a tool for them, and so forth and so on. These kind of lawyers don't exist anymore. A lawyer that writes a letter to the lawful authorities and says, I have a couple of rifles in my office, and the first time any thugs appointed by you, called policemen, special officers, militia and so forth, the first time they come into my office and try to enforce any of your crooked laws, I just blow their brains out. Well, these kind of lawyers don't exist today. But they did exist, there were some of them in those days. Now, these miners had carried on great struggles in the West, particularly in the copper mines of Montana, in the gold and silver mines in Coeur d'Alene, Cudialan in Idaho, and in the lead, copper, the lead, silver, and gold mines of Colorado. I'll mention them in a few minutes. They had suffered one defeat after another because they belonged to the American Federation of Labor, and the American Federation of Labor was chopping them down as well as playing ball with the employers on an open basis. And while some of them were in prison in Boys, Idaho, their lawyer suggested to them that the most important thing they can do and the most intelligent thing they can do is to break away from the American Federation of Labor and build your own union. And the most prominent men among these that were imprisoned at this time was a man named Ed Boyce. He was a lead miner. And he thought the idea sounded pretty good. And when he got out of prison in 1893, he decided that the time was right to break away from the American Federation of Labor and build a new union. And he did. It was mainly through the efforts of Ed Boyce that the Western Federation of Labor, the Western Federation of Miners, was organized. To give you an idea of the type of man this fellow was, I just read very briefly a little quotation, the kind of man he was. In 1896, in his annual report to the Western Federation of Miners, this is the autobiography of Big Bill Haywood, who was the Secretary Treasurer of the Western Federation of Miners after 1899. In 1896, in his annual report to the Western Federation of Miners, Ed Boyce said that he hoped that before the time of the next convention, the marshaled trend of 25,000 armed miners will be heard throughout the West. That the time had come when the miners would have to protect themselves from thugs such as were used in Coeur d'Alene, in Cripple Creek, and in Leadville, and that he trusted every miner would get a modern rifle and a supply of ammunition. Hey, did you ever hear of a... Can you imagine what would happen today if a labor leader ever talked that way at an international convention? This man was a socialist, of course. He joined the Socialist Party with Big Bill when it was founded in 1900. When the Western Federation of Miners was organized, naturally the preamble stated that we're living in a capitalist society where those that do nothing grab everything, and those that produce all the wealth end up with the crabs in ice water. And they urged the workers to organize on a political plane and overthrow the government and take possession of the wealth that they produce. Now, when these strikes at the Western Federation of Labor of Miners ran, it's very important to get an idea of what kind of an organization the Western Federation of Miners were in order to understand how the IWW developed and how it developed its philosophy alongside of it. Now, in 1892, there was a strike in Coeur d'Alene. That was a big gold and silver operation in Idaho. And in the strike, 1,000 miners were held for 6 months in a concentration camp. Oh, not in the United States. That's only in Germany, isn't it? Or Russia. No, this was in the United States. That's how the mine owners controlled the entire political setup in the West. They did exactly what they pleased. And when there was a strike, they rounded up all the miners and the troublemakers they could get and put them in a concentration camp to wear down the strike. And in 1892, 1,000 of them were held for 6 months in a concentration camp, a bullpen, as the Wobblies used to call it, by federal troops, not local troops. In 1894, 2 years later, at Cripple Creek in Colorado, which was a 100% solid strike, there were approximately 1,500 of them held for 8 months in the concentration camp. Barbed wire, barracks, guarded by militia or the federal troops and so forth. This was repeated time after time in all the great struggles of the mine workers. And you can imagine how revolting this must be to an individual that has some sense of respect for his or her rights, who has some understanding of the gigantic profits that these money-crazed, arrogant mine owners are extracting out of the blood and bones of these mine workers. Now, Haywood, alongside of the miners, alongside of Ed Boyce, came a young man named Bill Haywood, who was part of the tradition of the American labor movement. He had no education, no formal education at all. Went to work in the mines when he was 13 years of age. Grew to be a big hulk of a man, 6'4", 6'5", weighing 275 pounds. A huge man, but as gentle as a little child. All his life he was known as a very gentle man in dealing with individuals. That didn't mean that Bill Haywood was some kind of a sissy when it came to dealing with the law or anything of that nature. He was most violent in dealing with the law. And in a number of cases was carried all kinds of wounds in his body from police treatments that he got, as well as being shot several times in Denver, Colorado, during the fight for the eight-hour day. Not only the fight for the eight-hour day, but for the enforcement of the law. Now, Haywood joined the Western Federation of Miners in 1896. And by 1898, he was the president of the Miners Union in Silver City. And in 1899, when the Secretary Treasurer of the Western Federation of Miners was retiring, Ed Boyce suggested to Bill Haywood, who was a member of the executive board of the Western Federation of Miners, suggested to Bill Haywood that he become Secretary Treasurer to replace a man named Ma, who was resigning to become the sheriff of one of the counties in Idaho. And Haywood accepted it. He was 29 years old. At the same time, during this period, the United Mine Workers, the Western Federation of Labor of Miners, was pretty well fed up, right up to about here, with this idea of belonging to this phony craft union set up, the American Federation of Labor, and very unceremoniously just made the announcement that we no longer belong to the American Federation of Labor. And not only that, but we're going to form a new union, the American Labor Union, to fight the American Federation of Labor in the West in order to set up industrial unions. Before I go on, I might say that in the West, there were absolutely no Social Security laws or workmen's compensation and so forth and so on, there was also a flagrant violation of any kind of mining laws. The mining laws were a joke. Alongside of this, there were repeatedly all kinds of landslides on these little tiny valleys where the workers lived that worked in the mines. These mines were in the mountains. They weren't on the big prairies, but in the mountains. And come the winter, there'd be regular landslides, and 20, 30, 100, 200 workers and their families would be just wiped out. A little instance of how they dealt with the American Federation of Labor. In 1899, three leaders from the American Federation of Labor announced that they would like to attend the International Convention of the Western Federation of Miners. The Western Federation of Miners, this shows you the development and the stature of these men. We mustn't think of them as a pack of ignorant roughnecks, as the motion pictures always make us think of miners. The leadership of the union consulted the convention, and they said, yeah, let them come in. The three men came in. Bill Haywood tells of how the three big stuffed shirts from the American Federation of Labor came in. They went up to the platform, and at the signal from Boyce to stand up, they all stood up. The speakers were introduced. They sat down.
The speaker spoke.
When they got through, Ed Boyce gave a knock on the table from the stand-up, and the speakers walked out.